I'm Jewish.
I'm so Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
A lot of people say, I'm Jewish, I'm proud of being Jewish. First thing I ask them is, why?
I'm Jewish. Make something of it.
Welcome back to part 4 of 4 with Rabbi Adlerstein. And once again, he is clear and succinct and thoughtful. We start off with a discussion about women in Judaism, specifically Orthodoxy, and some of the jobs that they are restricted from participating in, such as singing or sports.
The idea that there are some jobs that are going to be closed to women and there's some jobs that are going to be closed to men just doesn't bother me so much. Yeah, it's true. I can, as much as I try, I will not be able to come up with a sound halachic basis for a woman becoming an exotic dancer. But there are enough things, enough avenues that are open for women that I'll have to say, no, that one I don't think I can help you with. But let's see if we can channel your energy in a different in a different direction. There are lots of jobs that are closed to men as well. Judaism isn't a question of making choices and denying yourself certain things for a greater good. I think that most sincere people are not worried about the notion that if they become fully observant as Orthodox women, they will not be able to enter Olympic competition in the 100-yard dash. Very few number of women who are negatively impacted in that manner. What they're worried about is, am I going to be shuttled into a second-class existence? Am I looked down upon? Is there a small number of options that are the only ones that are going to be open to me? And I think contemporary Orthodox experience belies that. And that's something you shouldn't hear from me. You should hear from an articulate Orthodox woman, of which there are countless numbers of representatives in our community.
I asked him bluntly, why are there so many Jewish lawyers?
We're taught to think critically and analytically and to take arguments apart from a very early age. So it really works out well.
We switch gears here, and I bring up an idea that I've heard in the conservative movement, which has to do with the standing silent prayer, which begins, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, and God of Jacob. And why does the mention of God happen 3 times? There's only one God. It could just say, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But it mentions it 3 times, because just like the forefathers had a personal relationship with God, a personal view of God, so do the 3 movements, the 3 major movements, Orthodoxy, Conservative, and Reform. So how does he react to that?
Wonderful. It says Elokei 3 times. So it must be that there are 3 different kinds of Judaism. Why not the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost? Give me a break. Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, true, means that those 3 patriarchs, each related or specialized to a different characteristic of God, discovered the rest of God through a window of one particular characteristic of God. Either chesed, the idea of giving and extending oneself further, which was the way Abraham approach God, or the contrary, Isaac's approach of finding control and discipline from within. But that hardly makes room for any group of 3 different interpretations of religion. That's quite a quantum and illegitimate jump from that blessing to what thousands of years of Jewish experience have been like. I remember up until a couple 100 years ago, there was no Jewish unity. There were splinter groups. But there were 2 things true of all splinter groups in Judaism. A, none of them survived. B, the splinter groups all disputed only 1 thing. Who had the right interpretation of Torah? No one disputed the idea that there was a Torah, that the Torah was binding, and that the Torah came from God.
So I ask him, what about the numbers? There are many more conservative and reformed Jews than Orthodox Jews, and don't we rule with the majority?
I'm not sure the Jews were ever concerned with numbers. The Bible itself says that it's not because you are the most numerous of people that I chose you. Jews were always the odd man out. There were times that the Jewish population was smaller, and the times that the Jewish population was larger. But we have this covenant with God and this promise that no matter what our numbers are, we will survive to the end of time. We're the only denomination that can actually say that with any kind of assuredness at the moment, because that's not where everybody else is heading. They are heading to self-annihilation through assimilation and intermarriage.
It's funny to me because the conservative movement won't accept the Reform conversions based on the fact that Reform doesn't require the rituals of conversion, and the Orthodoxy won't accept the conservative conversions because the conservative movement doesn't require the convert to accept the yoke of Torah, and they also don't always accept the Beit Din. So what's the difference between the two views?
I wish I knew the answer to that. What's the difference between the way Orthodoxy views conservatism and conservative conversions and the way conservative views Reform? On paper, nothing at all. And in practice, even, nothing at all. The conservative movement does not accept Reform conversion. The ironic thing about it is that in Israel, the two of them gang up together to say, well, the one thing we don't like is Orthodox conversion. We have to liberalize the rules, even though the two movements themselves can't really get together on a common basis. The only thing that combines them together is they know they don't like the Orthodox.
He brought up Israel, so it reminded me of one of the quirky anomalies of the Israelis is that a lot of Israelis don't observe Torah commandments. They will violate Shabbat and the holidays, yet the joke is the synagogue they don't attend is Orthodox. Why is that?
98% keep a mitzvah on their doors. An amazing percent say that they keep kosher even when traveling on the road and even outside of Israel. A very large percentage, well over plurality of Israelis, of these so-called traditional Israelis or secular Israelis, maintain that they have some kind of Shabbat. They're driving and they're watching TV, but they mark Shabbat to a certain extent. That's way ahead of where Americans are at. Way different. The unaffiliated Jew in Israel, first of all, the shul that he doesn't attend is Orthodox. He knows where to find the real stuff when he wants it. And are tied in culturally and even religiously, the major parts of Jewish observance. Remember, even from the standpoint of Orthodoxy, the first question they ask you when you get to the other side is not, so which denomination were you with? And if you say Orthodox, okay, you can stay up here, we got a great place for you. They rate you according to what you could have become. And every moment of your life is examined for what it could have become. Labels aren't important.
I asked him whether he thought the conservative movement could make the same kind of headway in Israel as it did in America. Why or why not?
In the 1950s, the conservative movement had a growth spurt, and they attracted a huge number of people, especially those who moved away from the cities to new suburban tracts where they were not within walking distance of a synagogue. So the conservative movement opened their doors and said, you know what? Drive. Won't hurt you. We'll tell you it's really okay. And their ranks swelled. Will the same thing happen in Israel? To a much lesser extent. Remember, even without government recognition, Reform and conservative denominations operate within Israel as competitors. True, they don't have the government recognition, but they set up shop anyway, and there's American funding for them, and there's a certain amount of popularity. They will attract some people who are looking for what they think is a point in between secularism and Orthodoxy, but they will not have the success that they had in America, because the vast majority of Israelis would still prefer to have the real thing when they want it, rather than to water it down.
So I wonder about the conservative rabbis who do expect their congregants to perform the commandments, to perform mitzvot. What about them?
I understand that, but I don't think that the conservative movement has Jews who are performing mitzvot. Now, don't get me wrong. Of course they're performing mitzvot. But experientially, I'm not sure that as many people as they would like are performing what they regard as the spoken word of God, that they are obligated to observe, not because they want to or find it uplifting or effective, but because God said so. This idea of hewing to a line because this is what God told us to do, I don't see present so much.
So is there a hypocrisy in the conservative rabbinate that says the commandments are binding, yet not always?
I don't know if it's hypocrisy. I think it's inaccurate, and that it ultimately will not lead to a full sense of fulfillment or getting back out of Judaism what it's intended to give you. But again, to whatever extent he's having people perform commandments of the Torah, that's positive. If he's telling them at the same time that it really doesn't come from God, that's something else. But if in your hypothetical that he's telling people that you should do this and it's better than doing nothing, fine.
Sticking with the topic of conservative Judaism, I bring up the notion that the origin of the Torah is sometimes pointed as divine, but human created, or humans wrote the Torah, but they were divinely inspired. And he brings up a document that tried to explain the conservative movement in 1988, but he forgot what it was called. I think he's referring to Emet ve'emunah, which is the statement of principles of conservative Judaism, which means truth and faith. Here he is.
Exactly what does that mean? Divinely given to humans who then wrote the Torah. Given to whom? I haven't found people in the conservative movement who could tell me what that means. You look at the... what's the name of the document? The one that was done about 10, 15 years ago. Sort of a small booklet explaining what conservative movement is about. Someone came to the idea of the divinity of the Torah, and there were like seven different... Some of us believe this, some of us believe that, some believe it's a metaphor, some believe there may be some propositional content. What does it all mean?
We now switch to the topic of marriage and the marriage contract specifically, which is called the ketubah, or the ketuvah, as he pronounces it. And I wonder, doesn't this connect conservative and Orthodox Judaism, because they both agree it's necessary? And what about reform?
Reform don't need a ketubah. I mean, if they want to, they chose it. But the sky's the limit on what they do. The conservative movement, it's hard to say. It's the conservative movement is like the weather in Cleveland. You don't like it? Wait 20 minutes.
And what about the critics who say that the ketubah is one-sided and favors the man?
The ketubah itself is one-sided for the simple reason that there are expectations and halachic demands on both husband and wife. Those demands don't have to be shored up by a document. The purpose of the ketubah is not to remind people of what their expectations or what performance obligations are part of marriage. That's encoded in the law books. The ketuvah is there to safeguard monetary interests of the wife. At a time that in the secular world, which is the Roman world, wives were chattel of their husband, literally chattel of the husband, to the extent that people accused of high crimes, their wives became property of the state, in the full meaning of the word. Meanwhile, back at the Jewish ranch, we were writing huge tomes in the Talmud protecting the property that a woman would bring into a marriage so that it would be there for her in the case of death or divorce. Ketuvah is there to protect the property of a woman and primarily to make divorce a non-casual thing, to make sure that there would be monetary obligations placed upon the husband in case of a divorce that would make trivial divorces or spur of the moment divorces unattractive. It's a way of dealing with hot-tempered men. People who haven't studied, or people who've studied and don't like the idea that it's all one-sided, say if it's one-sided, we're with the Supreme Court. There's no separate but equal. Judaism's not with the Supreme Court. There is separate and it can be equal, and we have no problem with that.
What's the difference between ritual and superstition?
Anything that really is accurate and a reflection of God's will is ritual, and anything which is not is superstitious. Now, point to a specific thing and ask me, I at times will have to shrug my shoulders. Are there superstitions that crept into Jewish practice? Yes, there were. We don't circumcise because it's healthier, because it'll lead to a lower incidence of cervical cancer in their spouses in the future, although that's true. We circumcise because God said, do it. And we believe that that is a reflection of God's will. And this is one of the reasons why it's just so upsetting listening to the different voices in the Jewish world today. In some fundamental areas of Jewish belief, there are non-Jewish religions that are closer to Judaism than some of the non-Orthodox denominations.
So given the complexity of the various movements and their different attitudes towards the law, I ask him as a final question, what's our best bet to guarantee Jewish continuity?
Actually, I'm going to punt to Dennis Prager, who observes that if you walk into the homes of many Reform Jews, you will find pictures on the wall, paintings on the wall, photographs on the wall of dancing Hasidic Jews. He has never walked into the house of a Hasidic Jew and found pictures of dancing Reform Jews. If you want to maximize the possibility of Jewish identity of your kids, you have to generate passion, not just identity with or commitment to, but passion. Living an observant, authentic Torah lifestyle with all of the beauty that goes with it, the tranquility of Shabbat, the discipline, the respect of men and women for each other, the positives and the lacks of the negatives, that can bring passion in a Jewish child. There's still no guarantees. There always will be dropouts. We live in an open society. But the way to maximize the probability is by giving your kids enough to really love that they love it more than the competitor elements in life, than the competing elements in life.
Thank you once again to Rabbi Adlerstein for being so generous with his time and being a forthright voice for Orthodoxy in the film, Why Judaism? Speaking of that, I'm going to have to take a hiatus, I think, from this podcast production because it does take time and I need to get to the editing bay. That film is not going to edit itself. So in the meantime, you can visit the sponsor, Hazaka.com. That's HAZAKAH.com, Jewish games that feed the brain. And check in with the website, whyjudaism.org. That's whyjudaism, whyjudaism.org. Let us know if you like the podcast, and we'll be in touch when another recording is posted. Thanks for listening.
All right, that's it. Hot as hell, Jay.